Today's Taisho will be on case 42 in the Book of Serenity. Case 42 is entitled Nanyang's Water Pitcher. Introduction. Introduction. Washing the bowl, adding water to the picture are all aspects of the teaching. Buddha work, hauling firewood and carrying water are all miraculous powers of sublime functions. Why can't you emanate light and make the earth move? Case. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyang, what is the virochana of one's own body? The national teacher said, bring me the pitcher of clean water. The monk brought the pitcher. The national teacher said, put it back where it was before. The monk again asked, what is the virochana in one's own body? The national teacher said, the ancient Buddha is long gone. Verse, birds coursing the sky, fishes being in the water, in rivers and lakes forgetting, in clouds and sky they get their will, the doubting mind a single thread, before the face a thousand miles, knowing benevolence, requiting benevolence, how many people do? So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning and doing such an excellent job, sitting so deeply. And we really do a lot of sitting. It's great. It's just like a Zen temple in Japan or China. We do a lot of sitting, and there's no substitute for long periods of meditation. There's just nothing like it. It's impossible to acquaint yourself with your true nature unless you do a lot of meditation. So anyway, there's a commentary on this koan that I'd like to read. I don't always read the commentaries in the Book of Serenity, but I think this one is worth reading. The flight of birds in the sky, the fish in the water, their roosts are ever more peaceful. Their life is ever more harmonious. Chuanzi said, when the spring is dry, the fish together on the land puff at each other to moisten each other with wetness from their mouths. This does not compare to forgetting each other in rivers and lakes. Chan Master Tonghui Gi from Bai Zhao said, it is like flying birds in the sky. They don't know the sky is their home. The fish swimming in the water forget the water is their life. Wei Feng said, the fish are not conscious of water. People are not conscious of air. Illusion is not conscious of reality. Enlightenment is not conscious of emptiness. Usually the personal virochana, complete pure awareness, manifests form in the human realm. As soon as it is questioned, a shadow appears. You forget the blessings you have received, turn away from your parents and go to strangers. Ultimately, if he can get rid of the spiritual seat, only then can the son take up the father's work. But tell me, what is the father's work? When brought up, there's nothing that is not. Don't doubt its use. So that will maybe make a little sense in a while. I was reading the other day that birds fly around the world, right? This particular kind of sparrow is living in Central America right now, is living in Canada right now. And, as winter approaches, that bird is going to fly to Central America. And there are birds that make journeys even longer. In fact, even hummingbirds make the most extraordinary journeys, right, of, like 7,000 miles, little hummingbirds. I'm sure you all know about the monarch butterflies, right? Monarch butterflies there's like three main groups of monarch butterflies, and some go up the East Coast, and several of them go up the West Coast, and they go quite far north, and then they lay their eggs, and the eggs turn into caterpillars, and the caterpillars turn into butterflies, and they actually fly back to the place in Mexico where they're all from, even though the caterpillars don't remember where they came from. So, this is a phenomenon that is fairly well known now. People didn't know much about this 100 years ago, but all of these animals follow migration routes or travel routes, and nobody's known how they do it, because some of them, like the butterfly, are going to a place they never in their butterfly form ever visited, right? So how are they doing it? And they've done studies of things like pigeons, and they found that the pigeons have sensors. They can sense gravitational lines, and that they sort of orient themselves along these. They have sensors that allow them to grasp these gravitational fields, and they're aware of them, and they use those to navigate. But even if we say they use the gravitational fields to navigate, how did they know to use the gravitational fields to navigate, right? So, all of these cases are sort of like novelties for us, right? We know about that animals have what we call instincts, right? Animals have instincts. And so all of this goes under the heading of like instincts, right? So, if you read this in a newspaper article, or you read it in Time Magazine under the science section, or you read it in the New York Times under the science section, or you get Smithsonian Magazine or Nature, we read these things and they're novelties. And you think, oh, wow, that's really interesting. And then we put it aside. But we don't really think about the larger implications, right? We don't really think about the larger implications a lot of these creatures have a conscious life, right? So the birds in my backyard very clearly have, I have a couple bird feeders, and the birds in my backyard very clearly have a conscious life, right? When they come to the seeds, the feeder, and they want the seeds, they try to chase the other birds away from the feeder, right? It's like, this is my feeder. And I have a hummingbird feeder. And it has four little plastic flowers, and the birds can come in. I got the four because I had a one flower feeder, and the hummingbirds were fighting. So one hummingbird would come down and it would be drinking, and then another hummingbird would come and that hummingbird would chase him away and come back and drink some more. So I thought, well, I'll get a feeder that has four openings so they can all share, but they don't share. They still fight, right? They fight, they all want to have all four. So, it's pretty clear that they have a conscious life. My cat has a conscious life. My cat comes in to see me, and it definitely knows how to get my attention, and it knows how to get me to feed it. It knows how to get me to let it out. When it catches mice, it brings the mice up to, so I was just leaving this morning, and on the doorstep, my cat had left a little dead mouse. It was like, look at what he's giving me a present, right? You know, so he usually leaves the corpse on the step. And so I can see it, and he puts it just where I can see it, so I can appreciate that he's been working hard, right? So all of these animals have a kind of conscious life, and some of them are quite intelligent. So for example, you probably read about crows and ravens are supposed to be super intelligent, right? So a raven is so intelligent that it knows in hunting season what a hunter looks like and will follow hunters into the woods. And when they shoot the deer, you know, they generally remove its innards, because you don't want to have to carry all those intestines and the lungs. You just want to carry the part that's for meat. So, you know, hunters will butcher the animal, or partly butcher the animal, right on the site of its being killed. And the ravens know this. And they wait, they follow the hunters, they go into the woods, and then they will eat, you know, they'll eat the offal, the O-F-F-A-L that has been left behind. And it's like this rich source of, especially like liver, this rich source of nutrition. So, you know, how do they know that? You know, crows didn't read up on nutrition, and they somehow know this. And we can say, well, it's instinct, it's instinct. But, you know, actually the word instinct is really, really misleading, or it doesn't actually explain anything, right? It doesn't explain anything. Because actually, you know, humans have instincts too, right? Humans, we think, well, animals have instincts, but we don't. But, you know, I can remember that when I was in middle school, you know, my interests changed. You know, when I was in elementary school, mostly I wanted to have friends. So my biggest goal in life was to have friends when I was an elementary school student. And I find, you know, I had some people who became my friends. You know, there was a guy named Mark Miller, and there was a kid named Freddie, and I can't even remember his last name anymore. There was a guy named Nick Tringali, right? So I had a friend named Peter von Gronfeld. Anyway, I had about five friends that were good friends. We'd meet in school. Sometimes we were in the same class for a year. After class, we would play. So, you know, it was very important for me to maintain my contacts with my friends and to have friends and to be liked by my friends. But when I went to, and I was happy with my relationship with my friends, pretty much I could go over to their house on a Sunday afternoon or a Saturday afternoon, and we could find something to do. We could walk around and have a good time. We very rarely quarreled. They were nice kids. So, but when I entered, say, maybe the ninth grade, I began to care less about what my friends thought of me, and I began to be interested in girls, right? I just began to be interested in girls. And, you know, I have to say, until I hit puberty, I didn't give girls a second thought. I had a sister, I had a mother, I had cousins, but, you know, it's like the people who counted for me were my friends, and they were all boys, right? And there were some girls next door. There were the Morrissey girls. There were nice girls, and Lynn Ann Morrissey and Carrie Morrissey. Sometimes we would associate with each other, but they weren't, like, real to me. The people who mattered were Mark and Freddie and Nick. And suddenly, you know, when I hit puberty, I was suddenly very, it was like, oh, who cares about them, right? It was like, I'm very interested now in girls, right? And I remember when I was in the ninth grade, I fell in love with this girl named Pam. And there was a Halloween party, and I asked her if she'd like to go to the Halloween party with me. My mother was going to drive us to the Halloween party, and she said yes, and I was thrilled. It was like, for a week, I was sort of like walking on air, because this woman, Pam, or this girl, Pam, was going to go to the Halloween party with me. So, you know, what happened there was instinct, right? Instinct. And so humans have instincts too, right? Why did I become interested in girls around the ninth grade? Maybe a little late in my case. But why did I become interested in girls then and not earlier? Why did I not care about them? So the thing is, you know, humans have instincts too. You know, so for example, humans can be competitive, right? And some of that is probably cultural, but you know, humans all over the world are somewhat competitive with each other, right? You know, they've done research to see if sibling rivalry is universal or not. And all these anthropologists have looked at all these different societies, and there's different degrees of sibling rivalry, but there seems to be something like sibling rivalry in all these human communities all over the world. So humans have a kind of instinct too, right? So, you know, just like birds or just like those butterflies, right? And we haven't given much thought to it. So when we read that mourning doves navigate by these lines of magnetic lines, you know, we sort of think, well, you know, we're not mourning doves, we're not animals, we don't operate that way, right? But actually, you know, that may be a very, very false way to think about things, right? And we know about hormones now. You know, we say this is hardwired, but again, you know, hardwired doesn't really explain anything. First of all, our brains aren't wired, right? And most of the connections in our brain are not permanent, actually. So saying, you know, this is hardwired says we're like a computer. We do that. We have hardware and we have software, right? But that's probably not true either, right? That's a false comparison. So anyway, we are much less aware of our big mind than we probably should be. And this koan doesn't seem to make much sense because it's pointing to something that we're not aware of. You know, it's like long before you, let me put it this way. You know, long before we think about things consciously, we already live in a world that's like an orderly, coherent world. It's an orderly, coherent world. And it's an orderly, coherent world for us, and we don't have to think about it. And that's true for all sentient beings. So for example, you know, I was reading the other day that there are some insects that have like 1,000 eyes, right? They have like 1,000 eyes. And I was reading about bees, and bees actually have a completely different color spectrum than we do. Their eyes are sensitive for certain wavelengths of light. And that's also true for hummingbirds, by the way. Hummingbirds have a different visual array than we do. So they see the world very differently than we do. And things that we would just walk by, they're fascinated by and they get very excited by, right? So the thing is that, you know, it would be crazy in a way to say, okay, this insect has 1,000 eyes and we have 2 eyes, but we see the real world and the insect doesn't see the real world, right? Or I'm sure that they discovered that elephants can make sounds that are below the threshold of what we can hear. And so, you know, elephants make these sounds that are so deep, and they travel, because they're so deep, they travel for miles and miles. So that, like, I was reading that elephants can hear like 20 miles away another elephant. There's no way we could hear that because our ear can't pick up sounds that low. And there are also, including hummingbirds again, you know, there are also sounds that are too high for us to hear, right? But it would be, you know, naive to say that, you know, the world we hear with our ears is the real world, and the world that that elephants hear is not the real world, right? That's not reality. Reality is what we hear. Or we would say, you know, the creature with 1,000 eyes is not seeing the real world. With 2 eyes, we're seeing things as they really are. I hope this is making some sense. So you know, all these different animals, actually, I was reading about dogs the other day. And they said, you know, dogs primarily, as everybody knows, live by smell. And, you know, when a dog enters the room, the first thing it does, its olfactory senses go crazy. And they said it can tell all of this information that we have no access to. So there are actually dogs that can sniff out cancer. This is really true. This is not a folk story. There are dogs that actually are like have very high accuracy rates of smelling if you're unhealthy and in particular ways. So it would be a mistake, right, for us to say, oh, well, you know, dogs don't live in reality. We humans live in reality. You know, so our smelling is real and their smelling is not real. What they smell is not real. So what we realize then is, look, all of these different animals, these different sentient beings, live in their own world in a certain way that's created by their own senses. And they're all real, right? They're just taking in different information, some information we can't take in at all. And they're not taking in some information we take in at all. So, you know, a dog might come in the room and it might immediately smell you and realize you're a female and you're such and such years old, right? Maybe it registers all that. But it might not register that you just bought a new shirt, right? And that it's a very attractive shirt. They might not see the shirt. So it's a little naive for us to say, oh, well, the dog's world is a dog's world, but our world is reality. So you know, all of these different animals, all of these different sentient beings live in a world which is real for them. There's a real world, but the world is real for them in the way that they can have access to, see? So a hummingbird actually is taking, brains work very, very fast, faster than ours. Their reflexes are much faster than ours. The other day I was watching, I work in the backyard sometimes on my computer and sometimes I read, and I was watching this hummingbird just go, he was like nip, nip, nipping at the air. He's grabbing all these little gnats that I couldn't even see. And he was just sitting there scarfing down the gnats. And very fast, I could barely see him move. You know, so they have very, very highly, very active nervous system, and they move, their rhythm of their brains is much faster than the rhythm of our brains. So you know, the hummingbird is living in a reality which is like constructed by the hummingbird, the hummingbird's mind for it. And the dog lives in a reality. It's the dog's reality. It's not inferior reality to ours. It's a dog's reality. It takes in all this information and processes it. And, you know, humans live in their own reality, right? It's not a dog's reality. It's not a hummingbird, but it's not the reality. It's just our reality. Right? So, you know, there are even biological scientists who will point out that animals don't live in the same reality. This is fascinating to me. So for example, when a fly gets caught in a spider web, it doesn't understand what's happened to it because its cognitive reality isn't the same as a spider's. So it's not like the fly is flying around and it makes a careless error and it lands in the web, see? It's not like that. And it sees the spider and thinks, oh dear, I'm caught. Now the spider is going to eat me. The fly doesn't understand the spider's reality at all. It's not, the spider's world is not part of the fly's world. the fly gets caught in ways it doesn't even understand because it doesn't share that cognitive reality. And by the way, this is very common, actually. You know, so birds hit windows, and it's not that they're careless, right? Birds hit windows. It's not that they were careless; they were distracted, and they hit. Birds don't know what a window is. They don't understand glass. Their brains, their minds, don't allow them to understand glass. So huge numbers of birds hit the glass because they can't be taught, right? They can't be taught. They can't understand it. So all of these different sentient, this is like a very Buddhist way of thinking about things. All of these different sentient beings live in their own worlds, which their intelligence creates for them. See? And they're combining information all the time into like a coherent world for them. But the interesting thing is they don't know they're doing it any more than we know we're doing it, but something's doing it. See, this is really important. You know, we think we live in reality, but we don't live in reality. We live in a world that our minds have constructed for us. And you can say, well, I've never seen my mind constructing things for me. But actually, that's because it's so good at it, right? If this is making any sense. So, you know, when we walk into a room, you know, we're taking in all of this information. And people have wired up other people's heads, you know. And when we walk into a room, you know, we're taking in huge amounts of information and it's getting processed, you know. It's getting processed, but not much of it is getting processed consciously. You know, so I'm sure you know that, you know, they've done studies of people's mental processing and they found that most of our mental processing takes place at a subliminal level. Right? It's not accessible to consciousness, but we're processing all the time. So you know, when we come into a room, we're aware of, you know, like our orientation in space. We're aware of many other things, but not necessarily consciously. You know, you walk into the room and you look for a familiar face, and you might or might not hear things that are going on, but you aren't, generally speaking, radically disoriented, right? Because your mind is already organizing all these inputs into like this coherent unity, see? And, you know, even if you do something like, travel to a distant place, you know, I remember the first time I was in a rainforest in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, it's actually rather disorienting because there's no sun in the sky. It's a gray sky and it's very dark in the rainforest and there's all this moss all over the ground. And if you get off the hiking trail, it's very easy to completely lose any sense of direction. Right? So, we can be disoriented, but you gradually put it together. You know, I found your way back to the trail and so on. You know, our mind is like synthesizing all of this information all the time and making a coherent world for us. And it's doing the same thing for all these other sentient beings. It's doing it for birds in the sky. It's doing it for fish in the sea. See, this is before brain science, but the especially people in China and Japan understood this, and India, ancient India too, very well. You know, if someday in our study group, we'll probably read the Flower Ornament Sutra. But the Flower Ornament Sutra is all about how we build up a world, a coherent world. Our unconscious minds create a world for us that's coherent and reliable. And, you know, the flower ornament center says we do it by making, with patterns, patterns. We look for patterns or repetition. And as the unconscious mind looks for patterns, it begins to structure the conscious world we live in. So the unconscious mind is sort of like taking in these patterns and weaving them together like fabric. And we are the conscious part of our minds. We're aware of this whole world that seems absolutely real. It's so real, we never question its existence. And the koan is saying we're like fish or like birds. You know, fish live in water, but they don't know they live in water. They swim, but they don't know they swim. You know, it's all coming to them because they have a deeper intelligence, which has already knitted all this together for them. So I hope this is making sense. But we all have a big mind, which is taking in all this information and weaving together a coherent, unified world that feels totally natural and present. And it is natural and present, but it's been created by this deeper intelligence. And so, you know, you walk out in the woods and you're feeling totally natural, totally at ease, right? Why do you feel at ease, right? I mean, I was in the city the other day, and I was walking up Madison Avenue going to the museum to look at the paintings by Hakuin Zenji and Musō Kokushi at the Smithsonian, this great show they have. You know, and there's a hustle and bustle and there's traffic and there's noise. And I actually like going to the city, but it definitely has a different effect on me than when I go hiking. Before this last one, I went for a hike along the Delaware River. And it was just like, so, why was it so peaceful? And somebody said, why did you feel so relaxed when you were hiking along the Delaware River, but not so relaxed when you were walking up Madison Avenue? What can I say? You know, too much noise, or really, it's below the threshold of my conscious awareness. You know, Japanese people have a ritual even. You know, they know that when they go out into forests, it's called forest bathing. Maybe you've heard about it. Forest bathing, you know, when you go out into a forest and you take it in, somehow it resonates on this very, it's like bathing your sheen, your heart, or your kokoro, right? You're purifying yourself by being, why is it purifying? Why is it purifying? You can say, well, it's peaceful. Why is it peaceful? See, the thing is, our minds are creating this world for us. There is a real world, but it's taking all these inputs and creating and making this coherent world. And we don't generally realize this process unless something jolts us, right? Something happens. And then we're like the fish in the commentary who are lying on the ground, the water has receded, and they're like two fish out of the water, and one fish is trying to give the other fish like a little moisture so it doesn't die. And now it's like a crisis for these sentient beings because they don't know where they are, and their natural habitat has vanished mysteriously. So, you know, the problem from the Zen standpoint, the problem with our culture, our way of life, is that we spend a lot of time studying to use our small minds. Like we devote huge amounts of time to like our small minds. So, you know, we go to school, and I'm glad we go to school, and you learn how to add and subtract, and you learn calculus, you learn algebra first, you learn calculus, you learn trigonometry, you learn statistics, whatever. You learn French, you learn German, you can learn Hindi if you want, you learn Mandarin, If you're very adventurous, you can try to learn Japanese. You know, all of this is wonderful, right? All of this is wonderful. We believe in the discriminating mind, and we have created a whole way of life centered on it. And in fact, you know, as you know, knowledge is a commodity, right? Knowledge has become like a commodity. So we produce knowledge in our world the way people used to produce shoes, or we produce information the way people used to produce shoes or lollipops, right? It's like the industrial production of ideas or information. And we live in that world. So it was already a problem, and it's become like a super problem now. But we don't have a kind of deeper intelligence, right? The kind of deeper intelligence. We don't know how to use our deeper intelligence, how to access it, and how to like nourish it or draw nourishment from it, right? So you know, every once in a while, something will happen to us that it makes us like those fish out on land trying to blow moisture into each other's mouths. Something will happen to us that knocks the legs out from under us. And at that moment, you know, we no longer trust our life. We no longer trust our life. You know, and it can be like a cancer diagnosis, or, you know, a pink slip or something like that. And that shakes our faith in, we say, life. And actually, when those things happen, it can be a terrible, terrible experience. And nobody wants that to happen. But when it happens, you know, sometimes it awakens us to this deeper intelligence, right? And there are problems that we can't solve using our discriminating mind. You know, you know, a number of years ago, there was a person who used to be part of our group, and her son was like the perfect son. He was summa cum laude. I think he was studying political science. He wanted to go into politics. He was on a charity bike race, right, in Montana. And it was like from Bozeman to Butte or something. And this really happened. His bicycle was struck by somebody in a car who had been drinking, right? And he died. And the person had been drinking and had a rap sheet, right, of alcohol-related moving violations. And, you know, she, in my capacity as a Zen teacher, you know, she called me up and wanted to talk to me. So we actually met at the, if you remember, the Renewal Center in Princeton, where we used to sit. We met outside of that building. And, you know, she had met with a number of different religious teachers. And some people said, you know, your son is in heaven, and so on and so on. And she said, what do you have to tell me? And I said, you know, I don't think there's anything I can tell you that's going to make this any better for you, right? I could say your son's in heaven, but I don't think that's going to help. And anyway, I don't believe he is. And I could say, well, he'll be reincarnated. He'll come back as a bodhisattva. I said, I don't think that will help. And you know, there was, what I said was, and it wasn't very, maybe it wasn't very consoling, is that nothing is going to make this right for you, but your relationship to this event is going to change. You know, and that you need to be accessible to that change. You need to, you know, what I kind of said was, you need to let this process go on long enough for you to have your faith in life restored, even though this terrible thing has happened to you. I didn't quite put it that way. You never know how this goes over, right? Because I didn't get a letter from her 3 years later saying, thank you, my faith in life has been restored. And maybe it hasn't been restored. But, you know, there is this deeper coherence to things, right? There's a deeper coherence to things. And we can't get in touch with it with the little mind, with the discriminating mind. That's the mind that wants things to be right in a certain way. And the universe doesn't necessarily meet those expectations. But, you know, when we're processing with our deeper mind, we get this very different perspective. There's a kind of wholeness, there's a kind of wholeness mind at work. You know, the discriminating mind makes comparisons. It cuts things into pieces. It evaluates. It assesses. It looks for flaws, you know, and so on and so on. It wants to make sure that X equals Y, and so on. But there's this other intelligence, which is like a wholeness mind, right? And if we allow it to operate, it has this astonishing power to open things up for us. It has like deeper intelligence. Right? So even a terrible loss, you know, actually can open the world up for you and be actually connect you more deeply to the world. Now, there's a very famous story in the Pali Sutras. You know, this woman had this terrible tragedy that happened to her. It's unbelievable, and I don't know how I would react if it happened to me. But this woman came to the Buddha, and she was inconsolable, and she said to him, you know, I'm sure you maybe have heard this famous story, but she said, my son has just died and I can't get over it. And he said, you know, I said, that's terrible. Here's what I'd like you to do. You know, I want you to go around the village and I want you to ask everybody, I want you to, you know, like put a mustard seed in a jar each time somebody says they have not had a family member die. And of course, she came back with an empty jar. And, you know, the experience of losing people we love is horrible. But the strange thing is that we share those experiences with each other. You know, those are things that actually deepen our ability to be at one with other people. You know, loss, you know, when we experience a loss, we're all like ashamed, or we feel like isolated. And if it's the loss of somebody, you know, especially the loss of somebody you love, it just feels incomplete. I mean, it's happened to me. You feel so isolated. And then you realize, you know, I'm not the only person whose brother died, you know, at 50, you know, I'm not the only person who's lost somebody. You know, suddenly you look around and you see all these people who have lost people they love. And you realize, you know, I'm connected to all of these people. You know, we're all living the same life, we're all feeling the same pain. And, you know, instead of being like a hellish experience, suddenly I feel liberated by that myself. You know, I feel like, you know, I'm connected. I don't even know these people, but you know, they've had the same loss. I feel connected to them. You know, I love them in a certain way. I don't know them, but I sure know their pain. So, you know, that knits us together in a very deep, we suddenly realize, you know, before they're just people out there, right? Very disconnected. But, you know, we've all had these experiences of loss, and suddenly we feel, these are my brothers and my sisters. You know, we have all been through this together, even though we didn't live through it together. We've all been through this experience. It's binding us together. You know, and that's the beginning of a deeper life. You know, I'm so sorry for that woman who lost her son. But, you know, actually, I was just reading the other day, you know, sometimes I'll be writing for like 8 hours and I can't do any more writing. And I'll sit and Google like old friends. Right? I'll think, well, I wonder what happened to so-and-so. And I'll Google. It's amazing and frightening how much stuff you can find out about people on the internet. But there was a guy in our Zen group, his name was Howard, in Seattle, who had a woodworking company. He made beautiful, like Scandinavian furniture. I won't tell you his last name. But he had a Dharma name. He took a Dharma name with Genki Roshi. His name was Oshin. And anyway, he was a lovely man. And he let us use his house as our Zen house for about 2 years. And it was right up on Capitol Hill, if you know Seattle. It was wonderful. And it made it, and we could all easily get there. After he wanted his house back, it made sense. He fell in love. He wanted to start his life as a couple. And we moved into a warehouse in central Seattle. It didn't work out. We had a period of wandering, trying to recover from this. But, you know, he had a wonderful spouse. We used to have parties at his house that were wonderful parties. He and Genki Roshi were good friends. So I was just Googling. I said, when would it have happened to Oshin, to Oshin, Howard? And his company was called something like the Heartwood. Anyway, his wife was killed, unbelievable, like in a bicycling accident. And it was like another charity bicycling accident or something like that. And this happened like 8 years ago or something. So, you know, again, it's horrible. I can't believe that happened to him, and I'm so sorry. And, you know, I hadn't thought about him in 35 years. And when I read this, I was so, so sorry for him because he was such a good man, you know. These things happen to all of us. And, you know, when we try to think them through, they can make us really bitter and angry and isolated. But there's a way of processing this information with the bigger mind, And suddenly we realize how, you know, we're all connected, all sharing one life. You know, when something is taken away, there's no putting it back. But sometimes when something is taken away, we become aware of something that's like a bigger one. It's a bigger one. So you take something away, but there's a bigger one there. And we can't even see it until something is taken away. So we go to school and we learn how to use the mind that notices what's taken away, but we don't get like an education in the big mind. That's what we're doing. This, I wish this were part of the standard curriculum. We're learning how to make contact, get in touch with, and learn from, be instructed by, edified, and illuminated by this big mind. And we're correcting a big problem in our education. And I want to thank you all for being such diligent students, doing the work so beautifully this morning. A monk asked national teacher Zhang of Nanyan, what is the varochana of one's own body? In other words, in one's own body. And Varochana is the Dharmakaya. Varochana is enlightened, the pure enlightened mind nature of the Buddha. So what is the pure enlightenment in one's own body? The national teacher said, bring me the pitcher of clean water. The monk brought the pitcher. The national teacher said, put it back. Now, all of these things are happening below the threshold of our conscious awareness. We know what a pitcher is for. We know where water goes. Nobody taught us to put water in a glass. We knew how to do that. How did we know? Nobody taught us actually how to use a door. How did we know, right? Okay, the monk said, so the teacher is trying to demonstrate that the big mind is knitting together for this person the world. And the monk doesn't get it. He's not ready yet. And the monk asked the question again. He didn't get the lesson. And so the national teacher said, well, you know, the Buddha is long gone. You missed your opportunity to see the big mind at work. But, you know, when we do a lot of zazen, we stumble into it. We suddenly realize there's like, we begin to make contact with this mind that's bigger than the small self. And we begin to trust this bigger mind, which is doing all the work. We're just walking along, enjoying the show, but something other than our small mind is making all this happen. Birds coursing in the sky, how do they know where to go? Fish being in the water, in rivers and lakes, forgetting. In clouds and sky, they get their will. The doubting mind, a single thread. Before the face, a thousand miles, knowing benevolence, requiting benevolence. How many people do? How many people awaken to this beautiful big mind at work? Not enough. But you came here today to call on that mind. So thank you very much.